Only after it was uttered, its sour echo lingering in the air, did Vivian leave the cabin, closing the door behind her, vanishing forever. 26. I'm drunk by the time I'm again walking among the cabins, or more accurately, stumbling. With each step, the mulch path seems to shift under my feet. I overcompensate by stomping, trying to pin it into place, which makes me lose my balance more often than not. The end result is dizziness, or maybe that's just from the whiskey. I try to sober up as I stumble along. Years of observing my mother has taught me a few tricks, and I utilize them all. I slap my cheeks, I shake my arms and take deep breaths. I widen my eyes, pretending there are invisible toothpicks holding up the lids. Rather than head straight to Dogwood, I keep walking, pulled subconsciously in another direction, past the cabins, to the latrine. But I don't go inside. Instead, I lean against it, momentarily lost. I close my eyes and wonder why I've come here in the first place. I open them only when I feel a nearby presence, alarmingly close and getting closer. On the edge of my vision, I see someone round the corner of the latrine, a shape dark and swift. My body tenses. I almost scream, somehow managing to stop it when the shape comes into focus. Casey, checking to see who's there while sneaking a cigarette like a high school sophomore.
"You startled me," she says before a deep drag and a languid puff. "I thought you were Mindy."
I say nothing. Casey drops the cigarette, stubs it out.
"Are you okay?"
"I'm fine," I say, stifling a giggle even though my talk with Becca has left me feeling unbearably sad. "Just fine."
"My God, are you drunk?"
"I'm not," I say, sounding just like my mother, the words slurred into one. "I'm not." Casey shakes her head, part horrified, part amused.
"You better not let Mindy see you like this. She'll totally freak out."
She leaves. I stay, roaming the perimeter of the building, an index finger sliding along the cedar shingles. Then I see the crack, that gap between planks now stuffed with clay, and I remember why I'm here. I'm retracing my steps, going to the same spot I went after Vivian disappeared from the campfire. 15 years later, I can still see her and Theo together in the shower stall. I can still feel the heartache that caused, a muted memory pain. I also feel something else. A shiver of awareness jumping along the skin of my arms, the back of my neck. I look up expecting to see Casey again, or worse, Mindy. Instead, I see Vivian. Not all of her, just a glimpse as she rounds the corner of the latrine. A spray of blonde hair, a slip of white dress scraping the cedar wall. Before disappearing completely, she turns and peers at me from around the edge of the building. I see her smooth forehead, her dark eyes, her tiny nose. It's the same Vivian I remember from camp, the same one who later haunted me. I instinctively reach for my bracelet, finding instead only a patch of skin where it should have been wound around my wrist. It's not there. I check my left arm just to be sure. It's bare. That bit of string keeping the bracelet together had given way. Now it's lying somewhere on the grounds of Camp Nightingale. Which means it could be anywhere. Which means it's gone. I flick my gaze to the corner of the latrine. Vivian is still there, peering at me. I'm not going crazy, I think. I'm not. I rub the skin of my left wrist, as if that will somehow work the same magic as the bracelet. It doesn't help. Vivian remains where she's at, staring, not speaking. Yet I keep rubbing, the friction heating my flesh. I'm not going crazy. I want to tell her that she's not real, that she has no power over me, that I'm stronger than everyone realizes. But I can't. Not with my bracelet God knows where, and Vivian right there, and fear shooting like a bottle rocket up my spine. So I run. I'm not going crazy. Away from the latrine. I'm not going crazy. Back to Dogwood. I'm not. My run is really an uneasy combination of swaying, tripping, and lurching that ultimately lands me at the cabin door. I fling it open, push inside, slam it shut. I collapse against the door, breathless and frightened and sad about the lost bracelet. Sasha, Crystal, and Miranda sit on the floor, hunched over a book. My presence makes them look up in surprise. Miranda slams the book shut and tries to slide it under my bunk, but she's too slow, the gesture too obvious. I can clearly see what they were reading. Vivian's diary. "So all of you know," I say, still out of breath from my awkward trip. It's not a question. The guilt burning in their eyes already tells me that they do. "We Googled you," Sasha says, a finger pointed Miranda's way. "It was her idea." "I'm sorry," Miranda says. "You were acting so weird the past 2 days that we had to find out why." "It's okay. Really, it's fine. I'm glad you know. You deserve to be aware of what happened in this cabin." Exhaustion, whiskey, and sadness get the best of me, and I find myself listing to the side, like a sailor on a rocking ship, or my mother on Christmas Eve. I try to right myself, fail, plop down onto the lid of my hickory trunk. "You probably have questions," I say. Sasha's the first to ask one, of course, insatiably curious Sasha.
"What were they like?"
"Like the three of you, but also very, very different."
"Where did they go?" Crystal asks.
"I don't know," I say. "Yet I would have gone with them. It's one of the few things I'm certain of. That despite Vivian's hurtful betrayal with Theo, I still wanted her approval. And had she asked, I would have willingly followed, marching behind them into the darkness." "But that's not the whole story," I say. "There's more. Things no one but me knows." Seeing Vivian again has messed with my emotions. I want to laugh. I want to cry. I want to confess. Instead, I say, "Two truths and a lie. Let's play." I slip off the trunk, joining them. It's a sudden, ungainly slump that makes the three of them recoil when I hit the floor, even Miranda, who I thought was the bravest of the group. 1. I have been to the Louvre twice. 2. 15 years ago, three of my friends left this cabin. No one saw them again. I pause, hesitant to speak aloud something I've avoided saying for 15 years. But no matter how much I want to stay silent, guilt compels me to keep talking. 3. Right before they left, I said something. Something I regret. Something that's haunted me ever since. I hope you never come back. The memory of that moment arrives without warning. It feels like a sharpened sword swooping toward me, slicing me open, exposing my cold heart. "I told them I hoped they'd never come back," I say, right to Vivian's face. It was the last thing I ever said to her. Tears burn the corners of my eyes, grief and guilt bubbling out of me. "That doesn't mean what happened to them is your fault," Miranda says. "Those were words, Emma. You didn't make them disappear." Sasha nods. "It's not your fault they didn't come back." I stare at the floor, avoiding their sympathy. I don't deserve it. Not when there's still more to confess. Still more I've kept hidden from everyone.
But they did come back. A tear slips out, rolls down my cheek. Later that night, only they couldn't get back into the cabin.
Why?
Miranda asks. I know I should stop. I've already said too much. But there's no turning back now. I'm tired of omitting things, which is practically the same as lying. I want to speak the truth. Maybe that's what might finally heal me. Because I locked the door behind them. Miranda sucks in air, a muted gasp, trying to hide her shock.
You locked them out?
I nod, another tear falling. It traces the path of the first, deviating only when it reaches my mouth. I taste it on my lips. Salty. Bitter. And I refuse to let them back in. Even after they knocked and jiggled the doorknob and pleaded with me to let them in. I look to the cabin door, picturing it the way it appeared that night. Pale in the darkness, dusted with moonlight, doorknob rattling back and forth. I hear the sharp rapping on the wood and someone calling my name on the other side.
Emma.
It was Vivian. Come on, Em, let me in. I shrank into my bottom bunk, squeezing myself into the corner. I pulled the covers to my chin and huddled beneath them, trying to will away the sound coming from the other side of the door.
Emma, please.
I slid under the covers, lost in the darkness within, staying there until the knocking, the rattling, Vivian herself, faded away. I could have let them in, I say. I should have, but I didn't. Because I was young and stupid and angry. But if I had let them in, all three would still be here. And I wouldn't be carrying around this awful feeling that I killed them. Two more tears follow the designated path. I wipe them away with the back of my hand. I paint them. All three of them. Every painting I've finished for years has included them. Only no one knows they're there. I cover them up. And I don't know why. I can't help myself. But I can't keep on painting them. It's crazy. I'm crazy. But now I think that if I can somehow find out what happened, then maybe I'll be able to stop painting them. Which means that maybe I've finally forgiven myself. I stop talking and look up from the floor. Sasha, Crystal, and Miranda stare at me, silent and motionless. They look at me the same way children eye a stranger, curious and skittish. I'm sorry, I say. I'm not feeling well. I'll be fine in the morning. I stand, woozy, swaying like a storm-battered tree. The girls slide out of my way and start to climb to their feet. I gesture for them to stay where they are. Don't let me spoil your night. Keep playing. They do, because they're nervous, because they're scared, because they don't know what else to do but to keep playing, appeasing me, waiting until I pass out, which likely will be any second now. One more round, Miranda says, her decisiveness not quite masking her fear. I'll go. I close my eyes before crawling into bed. Rather, they close on their own, no matter how much I try to keep them open. I'm too tired, too drunk, too emotionally flattened by my confession. Temporarily blinded, I feel my way into bed, reaching for the mattress, my pillow, the wall. I curl into a ball, my knees to my chest, back turned to the girls, my standard humiliation position. One, I once got sick after riding the cyclone at Coney Island. Miranda's voice slows, cautious, pausing to hear if I'm asleep yet. Two, I read about 100 books a year. Sleep overwhelms me immediately. It's like a trap door,
opening up beneath me. I willingly fall, plummeting into unconsciousness. As I tumble, I can still hear Miranda, her voice faint and fading fast. 3. I'm worried about Emma. This is how it continues. You scream again and again. You do it even though you don't know why. Yet you also sort of do. Because no matter how much you try, you can't rid your mind of those too terrible to think thoughts. Deep down, you know that one of them is true. So you scream one more time, waking the rest of the camp. Even standing in the lake, 10 feet from shore, you can sense a wave of energy pulsing toward you. It's a sudden jolt, a collective surprise. A heron on the shore senses it and spreads its long, elegant wings. It takes flight, rising high, riding the sound of your screams. The first person you see is Franny. She bursts onto the back deck of the lodge. The screams have already tipped her off that something is wrong. One quick glance at you in the water confirms it. She flies down the wooden steps, the hem of her white nightgown fluttering. Chet is next, all sleepy eyes and bedhead. He stays on the deck, unnerved, his hands gripping the railing. After that comes Theo, not even pausing, racing down the steps. You see that he's clad only in a pair of boxer shorts. The sight of all that exposed skin, obscene under the circumstances. You look away, queasy. Others have gathered along the shore, campers and counselors alike, standing motionless in the mist. All of them scared and startled and curious. That above everything else. Their curiosity comes at you like a frigid wind. You hate them just then. You hate their eagerness to learn something you already know, no matter how terrible it may be. Becca Schoenfeld stands among them. You hate her most of all because she actually has the gall to chronicle what's happening. She elbows her way to the front of the crowd, her camera raised. When she clicks off a few shots, the noise of the shutter skips across the lake like a flat stone. But it's only Franny who comes forward. She stands at the edge of the lake, her bare toes this close from the water. "Emma," she says, "what are you doing out here? Are you hurt?" You don't answer. You're unsure how. "Em?" It's Theo, whom you still can't bear to look at. "Come out of the water."
"Go back to the lodge," Franny snaps at him. "I can handle this."
She enters the lake. Not wading like you did, she marches, knees lifting, arms pumping, nightgown darkening at the hem as it sucks up water. She stops a few feet from you, her head cocked in concern. Her voice is low, strained but calm.
"Emma, what's the matter?"
"They're gone," you say.
"Who's gone?"
"The other girls in the cabin." Franny swallows, sending a ripple down the graceful curve of her throat.
"All of them?"
When you nod, the light in her green eyes dims. That's when you realize it's serious. Things move quickly after that. Everyone spreads out across the camp, going to places you've already looked. The fire pit, the latrine, the cabin, where Theo opens each hickory trunk cautiously as if the girls could be inside them, waiting to spring out like a jack-in-the-box. The hunt turns up nothing, which is no surprise to you. You know what's going on. You knew it the moment you woke up in that empty and silent cabin. A search party is organized, just a small one, an attempt by all to pretend the situation isn't as dire as everyone fears it truly is. You insist on tagging along, even though you're in no condition to be roaming the woods, calling out the names of girls who may or may not be missing. You march behind Theo, trying hard to keep up, ignoring how the chill of the lake water lingers on your skin. It makes you shiver, despite the fact that the temperature has inched past 90 degrees and that your skin is coated with a thin sheen of sweat. You search the woods that flank the camp, first one side, then the other. While marching through the forest, you picture Buchanan Harris doing the very same thing 100 years earlier, blazing a trail, armed with just a machete and willful optimism. It's a strange thought, silly, too, yet it takes your mind off your tired feet and sore limbs and the fact that a trio of dead girls might be waiting for you just around the next bend. No girls appear, alive or dead. There's no trace of them. It's as if they had never existed at all, like they were a figment of the camp's imagination, a mass hallucination. You return to Camp Nightingale during lunch, with all the remaining campers in the mess hall, picking at plates of sad, soggy pizza slices. Everyone looks up as you hobble inside. Various emotions swirl in their eyes. Hope, fear, blame. It's that last one you feel the most as you make your way to Franny's table. It heats the back of your neck like a sunburn. Anything? Franny asks. Theo shakes his head. A few of the campers begin to weep, their sobs breaking out all around you, disrupting the otherwise quiet of the mess hall. It makes you hate them all over again. Most of these crying girls barely knew the missing. You're the one who should be crying, but you look to Franny for guidance. She's not weeping. She's calm in the face of this unfathomable storm. I think it's time I call the police, she says. A half hour later, you're still in the mess hall. It's been cleared of crying campers and their equally moist-eyed counselors. The kitchen staff has been shuffled outside. The whole place is empty except for you and a state police detective whose name you've already forgotten. Now then, he says, how many girls seem to be missing? You notice his choice of words. Seem to be missing. Like you're making the whole thing up. Like he doesn't believe you. I thought Franny already told you everything. I'd like to hear it from you. He leans back in his chair, crosses his arms. If you don't mind. 3, you say. All staying in the same cabin? Yes. And you're sure you've looked everywhere for them? Not the whole property, you say, but the entire camp's been searched. The detective sighs, reaches into his suit coat, and removes a pen and a notebook. Let's start by telling me their names. You hesitate, because to identify them is to make it real. Once you say their names, they'll be known to the world as missing persons, and you don't think you're ready for that. You bite the inside of your cheek, stalling. But the detective stares you down, getting peeved, his face pinkening ever so slightly. Miss Davis. Right, you say. Their names. You take a deep breath. Your heart does several sad little flips in your chest. Their names are Sasha, Crystal, and Miranda. Part 2. And a lie. 27. The detective writes their names in his notebook, thus making the situation official. My heart completes another sorrowful flip-flop in my chest. Let's go back to the beginning, he says. Back to the moment you realized the girls were missing from the cabin. An awkward moment passes in which I'm not sure who he's talking about. Which ones, I almost say. I can't help but feel like that 13-year-old, cowering in the presence of a different detective, asking me about a different set of missing girls. Everything is so similar. The empty mess hall, and the slightly impatient lawman, and my simmering panic. Other than my age and the new cast of missing persons, the only major difference is the mug of coffee sitting on the table in front of me. The first time around, it was orange juice. This isn't happening. That's what I tell myself as I sit rigid in my plastic cafeteria chair, waiting for the mess hall walls and floor to melt away. Like a dream, a painting splashed with turpentine. And when it all slides away, I'll be somewhere else, back in my loft, maybe, awakening in front of an empty canvas. But the walls and floor remain, as does the detective, whose name suddenly comes to me. Flynn. Detective Nathan Flynn. This isn't happening. Not again. Three girls go missing from the very same cabin, at the very same camp where three other girls disappeared 15 years earlier. The odds of that happening are astronomical. I'm sure Sasha, that tiny well of knowledge, would have a percentage at the ready. Still, I can't believe it. Even as the floor and walls stubbornly refuse to evaporate, and Detective Flynn keeps sitting there, and I examine my hands to make sure they're the hands of a woman and not a 13-year-old girl. This isn't happening. I'm not going crazy.
Miss Davis, I need you to focus, okay?
Flynn's voice slices through my thoughts.
I understand your shock. I really do. But every minute you spend not answering these questions means another minute goes by that those girls are still out there.
It's enough to shake off my lingering disbelief, at least for the moment. I look at him, fighting back tears, and say, "What was the question again?"
"When did you realize the girls were missing?"
"When I woke up."
"What time was this?"
I think back to the moment I awoke in the cabin. It was only hours ago, yet feels like a lifetime. A little past 5.
"You always such an early riser?"
"Not usually," I say, "but I am here." Flynn makes a note of this. I'm not sure why.
"So you woke up and saw they were gone," he says. "Then what?"
"I went to look for them."
"Where?"
"All over the camp." I take a sip of the coffee. It's lukewarm, slightly bitter. "Latrine, mess hall, arts and crafts building, even other cabins."
"And there was no sign of them?"
"No," I say, my voice cracking. "Nothing." Flynn flips to a new page in his notebook, even though what I've told him amounts to only a few measly sentences.
"Why did you go to the lake?"
Confusion rolls over me again. Does he mean now? 15 years ago? "I don't understand the question," I say.
"Mrs. Harris White told me they found you standing in the lake this morning, after you realized the girls in your cabin were missing. Did you think they'd be there?"
I barely remember that moment. I recall seeing the sunrise over the lake, that first blush of daylight. It drew me to it. Flynn persists.
"Did you have some reason to think the girls had gone swimming?"
"They can't swim. At least, I don't think they can." I remember one of them telling me that. Crystal? Or was it Sasha? Now that I think about it, I don't recall seeing any of them actually go into the water. "I just thought they might be there," I say, "standing in the lake."
"The way you were standing in the lake?"
"I don't know why I did that." The sound of my voice makes me cringe. I sound so weak, so confused. Pain nudges my temples, making it hard to think.
"Mrs. Harris White also said you were screaming."
That I remember. In fact, I can still hear my cries streaking across the water. I can still see that heron startled into flight. "I was."
"Why?"
"Because I was scared," I say.
"Scared? Wouldn't you be if you woke up and everyone else in your cabin was gone?" "I'd be worried," Flynn says. "I don't think I'd scream."
"Well, I did. Because I knew what was going on. I was stupid enough to come back here, and now it's happening again." Detective Flynn flips to a fresh page,
Is there a chance you screamed for another reason?
Such as?
I don't know. Maybe out of guilt?
I shift in my seat, discomfited by Flynn's tone. I detect slight mistrust, a sliver of suspicion.
Guilt?
I say.
You know, for losing them when they were under your care.
I didn't lose them.
But they were under your care, right? You were their camp counselor?
Instructor, I say. I told them when I first arrived that I was here to be a friend and not some authority figure.
And were you? Flynn says. Friends, I mean.
Yes.
So you liked them?
Yes.
And you had no issues with them? No disagreements or fights?
No, I say, stressing the word. I told you, I liked them. Impatience nudges my ribs and shimmies down my legs. Why is he wasting all this time asking me questions when the girls are still out there, maybe hurt, definitely lost? Why doesn't anyone seem to be searching? I glance out the mess hall window and see a couple of police cruisers and a smattering of state troopers milling about outside.
Is someone looking for them? I ask. There's going to be a search party, right?
There will be. We just need some more information from you.
How much more?
Well, for starters, is there anything about the girls you think I should know? Something about them that might aid in the search?
Crystal is spelled with a K, I say, in case that helps.
It certainly will.
Flynn doesn't elaborate, leaving me to picture each of them on the sides of milk cartons, a noble public service that's actually horrible when you think about it. Who wants to open their fridge and see the face of a missing child staring back at them?
Anything else? Flynn asks.
I close my eyes, rub my temples. My head is killing me. Let me think, I say. Sasha, she's so smart. The downside is she knows so much it makes her a little scared. She's afraid of bears and snakes. It occurs to me that Sasha might be afraid right now, wherever she is. The others, too. It breaks my heart to think of them lost in the woods, terrified of their surroundings. I hope they're all together so they can comfort one another. Please, God, let them be together. I keep talking, overcome with the urge to tell the detective everything I know about the girls. Miranda's the oldest and the bravest. Her uncle is a cop, I think, or maybe it was her dad, although she lives with her grandmother. She never mentioned parents, come to think of it. A realization pops into my head, coming at me like a thunderclap. She took her phone.
Who did?
Miranda. I mean, I'm not certain she took it with her, but it wasn't among her things. Could that be used to find her? Flynn, who had been sagging in his chair while I prattled on, suddenly perks up.
Yes, it definitely could. All cell phones come with a GPS. Do you know the carrier?
I don't.
I'll have someone contact her grandmother and ask, Flynn says. Now, let's talk about why you think the girls are gone.
I don't know.
There has to be a reason, don't you think? Like maybe they left because they were mad at you about something.
Nothing I can think of. That's a lie. The latest in a long line of them. Because there is something that would make them want to leave Dogwood. Me. The way I acted. Drunk and crying and still touching my bare wrist, which now has a red streak on its side where my thumb kept rubbing the skin. I wasn't in my right mind last night, and it scared them. I saw it in their eyes.
You think they ran away? I ask.
I'm saying that's the most logical reason. On average, more than 2 million youth run away each year. The vast majority are quickly located and returned home.
It sounds like another one of those statistics Sasha would have at the ready, but I don't believe for a second the three of them ran away. They gave no indication of unhappiness in their home lives. What if they didn't? I say. What would be another reason?
Foul play.
Flynn says it so quickly it makes me gasp. Like kidnapping?
Is it a possibility? Yes. Is it likely? No. Less than 1% of all missing children are abducted by strangers.
What if the kidnapper isn't a stranger? Flynn quickly flips to another page of his notebook, pen poised over paper.
Do you know of such a person?
I do. Maybe.
Has anyone talked to the kitchen staff? I say. The other day, I caught one of them staring at the campers on the beach. Not a good stare, either. It was creepy.
Creepy? Like he didn't think it was wrong to ogle a 16-year-old girl.
So it was a male.
I gave a firm nod. The tag on his apron said his name was Marvin. Two other kitchen workers were there. Women. They saw the whole thing.
I'll be sure to ask around, Flynn says, writing down everything.
Seeing his pen scurry over the paper pleases me. It means I'm helping. Energized, I grab the coffee and take another bitter gulp.
Let's talk about 15 years ago, Flynn says. I've been informed you were here when three other girls went missing. Is that correct?
I stare at him, slightly uneasy. I assume you already know that it is.
You were staying in the same cabin, were you not?
I detect more suspicion in his voice, less subtle this time around. Yes, I say, buzzing with defensiveness. None of them, by the way, were among the vast majority you claimed to have been located and returned home.
I'm aware of that.
Then why are you asking me about it? Flynn pretends not to hear the question and plows ahead.
Back then, a fellow camper said she heard you and one of the girls who vanished fighting earlier that night.
Becca. Of course she told the police about what she'd heard. But I can't be too mad at her for that. I would have done the same thing if the roles had been reversed. It was an argument, I say weakly, not a fight.
What was this argument about?
I honestly can't remember, I say, when of course I can. Me screaming at Vivian about Theo. Just a stupid girl fighting over a stupid boy.
As you mentioned, none of those girls were seen or heard from again, Flynn says. Why do you think that is?
I'm not an expert on disappearances.
Yet you're hesitant to think this current set of missing girls ran away.
Because I know them, I say. They wouldn't do something like that.
And what about the girls who went missing 15 years ago? You knew them, too.
I did.
You knew them well enough to get angry at them.
One of them. I reach for the coffee and take another gulp, this time to steel myself.
Maybe even violently angry.
Flynn catches me mid-sip. The coffee stops halfway down my throat, choking me. I let out a series of short, rough coughs. Coffee and spittle fling from my mouth.
What are you implying? I say between coughs. I'm just being thorough, Miss Davis.
Maybe you should start searching for Miranda, Crystal, and Sasha instead. Be thorough with that. I take another look out the window. The troopers are still there, milling outside the mess hall. It's as if they're guarding the place, trying to keep someone out. Or someone in. A grim understanding settles over me. I now know the reason no one seems to be searching for the girls. Why Detective Flynn keeps focusing on my relationships with all of them. I should have seen it coming. I should have realized it the moment I woke up and Miranda, Sasha, and Crystal were gone. I'm a suspect. The only suspect. I didn't touch those girls, then or now.
You have to admit it's an awfully big coincidence, Flynn says. 15 years ago, all the girls from your cabin vanished in the night. All of them but you. Now, here we are, with all the girls from your cabin once again vanishing in the night. All of them but you.
I was 13 the first time it happened. What kind of violence do you think a 13-year-old girl is capable of?
I have a daughter that age, Flynn says. You'd be surprised.
And what about now, I say, wincing at both the hysterical pitch of my voice and the headache that accompanies it. I'm an artist. I'm here to teach girls how to paint. I have absolutely no reason to hurt anyone. In my head, a much cooler voice speaks to me. Keep calm, Emma. Think clearly. Go over what you know.
I'm not the only one who was here back then, I say. There are plenty of others. Casey, for example, although I doubt she could swat a mosquito, let alone hurt two sets of girls for no apparent reason. Then there's Becca, who definitely had a reason to hate Vivian, Natalie, and Allison. I think about Theo, about seeing him with Vivian in the shower, about me pounding his chest. Where are they? What did you do to them?
But Theo had a sound alibi 15 years ago. Franny is a different story entirely. Vivian's diary slides into my thoughts. I'm close to finding out her dirty little secret. I know the truth. I'm scared. I think you should talk to Franny, I say.
Why?
Vivian, she's one of the girls who vanished 15 years ago, was poking around camp, investigating.
Investigating what?
Flynn asks, his impatience more pronounced. God, I wish I knew. Although Vivian had left behind plenty of clues, there's nothing to pinpoint what exactly Franny might be hiding. Something Franny might have wanted to keep secret.
Wait, are you saying you think Mrs. Harris White did something to the girls in your cabin? Not just now, but also 15 years ago?
It sounds ridiculous. It is ridiculous. But it's the only reason I can think of to explain a situation that defies easy explanation. Everything I've learned since coming back to camp points to such a conclusion. Vivian was looking for something, possibly related to Peaceful Valley Asylum. She found it and enlisted the help of Natalie and Allison. All three promptly vanished. That can't be a coincidence. Now I'm back, looking for what Vivian was after, and Miranda, Crystal, and Sasha also go missing. Again, too strange to be a coincidence. It's possible Vivian stumbled upon something Franny was desperate to keep hidden. Perhaps something worth killing over. Now maybe I'm on the verge of finding it out too, and this is another warning from Franny. Her story about the Falcon shoots into my brain, breaking through all my other cluttered thoughts. Is that why she told it? To make me frightened enough to stop searching? Did she tell Vivian the same story after she'd been caught in the lodge? It makes more sense than thinking I did it, I say.
This is a good person you're talking about.
Flynn puts down his notebook, pulls out a handkerchief, mops his brow.
Hell, she's the biggest taxpayer in this county. All this land? That's a lot of property taxes she pays each year. Yet she's never complained, never tried to pay less. In fact, she gives just as much to charity. The main hospital in the county? Guess whose name is on the damn building?
All I know is that it wasn't me, I say. It was never me.
So you say. But no one knows what happened. We only have your word, which, if you'll excuse me, seems kind of suspect.
Something strange is going on here. The detective shoves the handkerchief back in his pocket and gives me an expectant look.
Would you care to elaborate?
I'd been hoping it wouldn't reach this point. That Detective Flynn would accept my word as fact and start trying to find out what really happened to Miranda, Crystal, and Sasha. But now there's no choice. I have to tell him everything. Because maybe everything that happened, the shower, the birds, the person at the window, wasn't directed at me. Maybe it was meant for one of the girls. Someone's been watching me all week, I say. I was spied on in the shower. Someone put birds in the cabin.
Birds,
Flynn says, once again reaching for his notebook. Crows, three of them. One morning I woke up and saw someone standing at the window. They'd vandalized the outside of the cabin.
When was this?
2 days ago.
What was the vandalism?
Someone had painted the door. I hesitate before saying the rest. They wrote the word liar. Flynn's brows arch, exactly the reaction I'm expecting.
Interesting word choice. Any reason behind it?
Yes, I say, annoyed. Maybe to preemptively make sure no one believes me.
Or maybe you did it to deflect suspicion from yourself.
You think I planned to abduct those girls?
That makes about as much sense as everything else you've told me, Flynn says.
My headache flares, a fire at my temples. This isn't happening. I'm not going crazy. Someone was watching us, I say. Someone was there.
It's hard to believe you without any proof, Flynn says. And right now there's nothing to back up your story.
Another realization swerves into my head, one I was too upset to conjure until just now. One that will prove to Flynn he's wrong about me. There is, I say, a camera pointed right at the cabin door. 28. The cabin glows green on the monitor, thanks to its night vision feature. It's an ugly green, a queasy shade made worse by the camera's position. Instead of a straight shot from the back of one cabin to the front of Dogwood, it's been angled downward into a bird's-eye view that induces vertigo.
The camera is motion-sensitive, Chet explains. It starts recording only when movement is detected. It stops when whatever it's recording also stops moving. Each time the camera records something, a digital file is automatically saved. For instance, this is a paused shot from the night it was installed.
On screen, the cabin door is ajar, the motion that triggered the camera. In that sliver of darkness, I can make out a foot and a green-tinted glimpse of leg. Chet moves to a second monitor, one of three that sit side by side in the lodge's basement. While most of the space is filled with tidily stacked boxes and cobwebbed furniture, just as Mindy had predicted on my arrival day tour, one corner has been outfitted with unpainted drywall and a floor of white linoleum. This is where the monitors reside, sitting on a metal desk with two PC towers slid together like books on a shelf. Chet occupies a creaky office chair in front of the desk. The rest of us, Theo, Franny, Detective Flynn, and myself, stand behind him.
This all seems pretty elaborate for one camera at one cabin, Flynn says. It's just a test camera, Chet replies. We're going to install more throughout the camp, for security reasons. At least that was the plan.
Behind him, Franny flinches. Like the rest of us, she knows there won't be a camp left unless Crystal, Sasha, and Miranda are found by the end of the day. This could very well end her dream of one last glorious summer.
The camera can also be set to a constant live feed. That's what this is.
Chet points to the third monitor, a daytime view of Dogwood.
Usually the live feed is turned off because there's no one to constantly monitor it. I turned it on while we're all down here, just in case the girls return.
I stare at the screen, hoping against hope I'll see Sasha, Crystal, or Miranda come into view, returning from an extended hike, oblivious to all the worry they've caused. Instead, I see Casey pass by, leading a group of crying girls to their cabins. Mindy appears next, bringing up the rear. She gives the camera a fleeting glance as she passes.
The recordings are stored here, Chet says, using a mouse to open a file folder located on the center monitor.
Inside are dozens of digital files identified only by a series of numbers.
The file names correspond to the day, hour, minute, and second each recording was made. So this file, 063-004-4833, means it was recorded on June 30th, 33 seconds after 4:48 a.m.
He clicks once and the image frozen on the first monitor jerks to life.
The door opens wider, and I see myself slip out of the cabin and walk awkwardly out of the camera's view. I recall that moment well, heading to the latrine at the break of dawn, armed with a full bladder and a swarm of memories.
"What were you doing up at that hour?" Flynn asks.
"I was going to the bathroom," I say, bristling. "I assume that's still legal?"
"Are there files from last night?"
Flynn asks Chet, who uses the mouse to scroll down and check the folders.
"Several."
Flynn turns to me.
"You said you realized the girls were gone at about 5, right?"
"Yes," I say, "and they were there when I went to sleep last night."
"What time was this?"
I shake my head, unable to remember. I was too dazed by whiskey, by memories, to keep track of the time.
"There's one file from between midnight and 4, Chet announces. "Then there are 3 between 4:30 and 5:30 this morning."
"Let's see them," Flynn says.
"This is from a little after 1.
Chet clicks the first file, and Dogwood appears. At first, there's no movement at all, making me wonder what triggered the camera. But then something appears, a green-white blur just on the edge of the screen. A mother deer and 2 fawns step into frame, their eyes giving off a chartreuse glow as they carefully cross in front of Dogwood. 20 seconds tick by as they make their way past the cabin. Once the second fawn exits the frame, its white tail flicking, the camera shuts off.
"That's it for those hours," Chet says. "This one is about 5 minutes before 5.
He clicks, and the first monitor lights up again. It's the same view as before, minus the deer, but with the addition of the cabin door slowly opening. Miranda is the first to emerge. She pokes her head outside, looking in both directions, making sure the coast is clear. Then she tiptoes out of the cabin, wearing her camp polo and cargo shorts. A pale rectangle is clenched in her hand. Her phone. She's soon followed by Sasha and Crystal, sticking close together. Crystal carries a flashlight and a rolled-up comic book stuffed into the back pocket of her cargo shorts. I can make out the edge of Captain America's shield emblazoned on the cover. Sasha carries a water bottle, which she drops when closing the cabin door. It rolls along the ground out of frame. Sasha runs after it, disappearing for a second. When she returns, the 3 of them confer in front of the cabin door, oblivious to the camera's presence. Eventually, they go right, heading toward the heart of camp, vanishing one by one. First Miranda, then Crystal, and finally Sasha. I make a note of the order in which they depart just in case I'll need to paint them one day. I hate myself for thinking this way.
"This is 5 minutes later," Chet says, once the screen goes dark and he opens the next file. I don't need to look at the monitor to know what it shows. Me emerging from the cabin in bare feet and the t-shirt and boxer shorts I wore to bed the night before. I pause outside the door, rubbing my arms to ward off the chill. Then I walk away in the opposite direction of the girls toward the latrine. Even though I know what to expect, the footage is a gut punch. 5 minutes. That's how little time had passed between the girls leaving the cabin and my realizing they were gone. 5 fucking minutes. I question every thought I had and every move I made this morning. If only I had awakened earlier. If only I hadn't wasted so much time thinking of reasons for why they'd be gone. If only I had gone to the mess hall instead of the latrine. In any of those scenarios, I might have spotted the girls retreating to wherever it was they went to. I might have been able to stop them. Even worse is how guilty it makes me look, stepping outside mere minutes after the girls departed. While it was a complete coincidence, it doesn't appear that way. It looks intentional, like I was waiting to follow them at a discreet distance. It doesn't matter that I went in the opposite direction, because the next video, the final one from that highly trafficked pre-dawn hour,
shows me walking past Dogwood during my wander around the cabins. I stare at my image on the monitor, noticing the hard set of my jaw and the blankness in my eyes. I know it's worry, but to others it might look like anger as I unwittingly followed the same path the girls had taken. I was looking for them, I say, preempting any questions from the others. It was right after I woke up and realized they were gone. I searched the latrine first, then looked around the cabins before heading to the other side of camp.
You've already mentioned that, Detective Flynn says. But again, there's no way to prove that. All this video does is confirm that you left the cabin not long after the girls did, and now no one can find them.
I didn't do anything to those girls. I look to Chet, to Theo, to Franny, silently begging them to back me up, even though there's no reason they should. I'm not surprised when, instead of coming to my defense, Franny says,
"Normally I wouldn't feel comfortable sharing this. Everyone has a right to privacy, especially regarding incidents in their past. But under these circumstances, I feel I must. Emma, please forgive me."
She offers a look that's half apology, half pity. I don't want either. So I look away as Franny says,
"Years ago, Miss Davis was under psychiatric care for an undisclosed mental illness."
While she talks, I stare at the third monitor, the live feed from outside the cabin. Currently, the area is empty. No campers, no Mindy or Casey, just the front door of Dogwood at that Hitchcockian angle.
"We discovered this during a background check," Franny continues. "Against the advice of our attorneys, we invited her here for the summer. We didn't think she was a threat to herself or the campers. Nonetheless, precautions were taken."
Flynn, proving himself to be nobody's fool, says,
"Hence the camera."
"Yes," Franny says. "I just thought you should know. To show we're doing everything we can to help in your search. I don't mean to imply in any way whatsoever that I think Emma had something to do with this disappearance." Yet that's exactly what she's doing. I keep my gaze fixed on the monitor, unwilling to look away because it would mean facing Franny again, and I'm not sure I can do that. On the screen, a girl edges into view, her back straight, her steps precise. She knows the camera is there. At first, I think it's a camper, maybe sneaking out of a neighboring cabin to get another peek of the state troopers milling around the mess hall. Then I see the blonde hair, the white dress, the locket around her neck. It's Vivian, right there on the monitor. I gasp in shock, a ragged, watery sound. Chet's the first to notice and says,
"Emma, what's wrong?"
My hand trembles as I point to the monitor. Vivian is still there. She looks directly into the camera and gives a coy smile, as if she knows I'm watching. She even waves to me.
"You see that, right?"
"See what?"
It's Theo this time, his brow creasing with doctor-like concern.
"Her," I say, "in front of Dogwood."
All of them turn to the monitor, crowding around it, blocking my view.
"There's nothing there," Theo says. "Did you see one of the missing girls?" Flynn says.
"Vivian. I saw Vivian."
I push between them, regaining my view of the live feed. On the monitor, all I see is that same angled view of Dogwood. Vivian's no longer there, nor is anyone else. I tell myself, "This isn't happening." I tell myself, "I'm not going crazy." It's no use. Panic and fear have already overtaken me, turning my body numb. A fuzzy blackness encroaches on the edge of my vision, pulsing across my eyes until I see nothing at all. My arm jabs forward, reaching for something to grab onto. Someone catches it. Theo, or maybe Detective Flynn. But it's too late.
My arm slips from their grasp, and I fall, crashing onto the cellar floor and fainting dead away.
15 years ago,